Welcome to the 2014 American Society of Agronomy Awards breakfast and our lectureship. My name is Jean Steiner. I work with the USDA Agricultural Research Service at the Grazing Lands Research Laboratory in El Reno, Oklahoma. And when I'm not doing my day job, I've been serving this year as the president-elect and on the program chair for the society. And it's been really a pleasure to represent you this year as one of your elected officials and to work very closely with the other president-elects and executives. So I'd like to introduce the society's officers, if they would please stand as I call their names. From Kansas State University, President Dave Mangle. From South Dakota State University, past President Sharon Clay. And from the International Plant Nutrition Institute, our incoming president, Paul Nixon. And I also want to introduce our Chief Executive Officer, Ellen Bergfield. And I also would like you to recognize all of our board members. If the board members would please stand and be recognized. Thank you, everyone, for the service. And where would we be without our section officers and our community leaders? So would the people who've been serving the society in those roles please stand? Thank you. We also are very pleased to welcome a special guest, the World Food Prize recipient, Sanjaya Rajaram. So please recognize him. And we're very lucky and fortunate and pleased to have a lot of our former presidents present, so please stand and be recognized. As we put these programs together and as we execute a lot of our programs of our society, we're very appreciative of all of our corporate members. In particular, this year we want to recognize a 25-year milestone, the Beet Sugar Development Foundation at the silver member level, a 20-year milestone, CID Bioscience Inc. at the platinum level, a 10-year milestone, IPI International Potash Institute as a gold member, and we have some new members we're very excited to welcome, Actaga LLC Platinum, the Samuel Roberts Noble Foundation at the platinum level, Yara North America Inc. as a gold member, AdaptN as a silver member, and Vision Research Park LLC at the silver level. So please thank all of these corporate members with me. And now I'm going to call forth Paul Nixon. He is, in addition to being our incoming president-elect at ASF, board member, and he's going to give the Agronomic Science Foundation report and present this year's Golden Opportunity Scholars. So, Paul.
Thank you, Jean. The markets really have been very good to the foundation this last year. We're currently sitting with a portfolio balance of $4.5 million. That's an 8% increase from a year ago, so the funds have done well. We received 249 gifts in 2013, totaling $474,000. In 2014 so far, we've given out just a little under $200,000 in awards, lectureships, and scholarships. It's been a busy year. One of the new programs we've got that we're just really excited about because it launches into a different type of funding support for ASF And that is the ASF Sustainable Research Program, which is funded through a generous donation from Monsanto. And I think we have several Monsanto representatives with us this morning. And if you, as you get to know the people at your table, if you have one of those folks with you, make sure you thank them for their generosity. This program set out an RFP. This was the inaugural year. We received 40 proposals. Six of those were funded for a total of a little over $200,000 of support. And a number of those went to young researchers that were just trying to get programs started. There'll be another RFP going out on this program in June of 2015, so watch for that. There'll be another set of projects funded. So we're, again, very happy to have this kind of a new function for ASF on board dealing with research support. Another new program that Sharon Clay, who we'll be hearing from a little later, is the Greenfield Scholars Program. And I'm not going to say much about this because you'll be introduced to the recipients later, and Sharon will say more about that a bit later. Very excited to have this joint program between ASF, the American Society of Agronomy, and also the International Certified Crop Advisor Program. It's a joint effort there. Another new effort for ASF was involving the support of two international soil judging teams that went to South Korea, a part of the World Congress of Soil Science. These two teams, four students in each team, coached by John Galbraith from Virginia Tech and Chris Baxter from UW-Platteville. They went there, of course, in international competition with soil judging teams from around the world, and as it turns out, they found that the toughest competition was from home because our two teams took first and second place in this international contest. So we were really proud of those students and their coaches, and it was fun for ASF to be involved in some way in supporting that activity. DIGIT, our wonderful soils exhibit, has been active. You remember this started, spent its first few years in the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. It's been moving around. It's currently out here in California, up in Sacramento. It'll be there until March of 2015, and then during the International Year of Soils, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a minute, it will head to Raleigh, North Carolina. And it'll spend a few months there this summer, and then it'll move again to St. Louis in September for the last few months of 2015 and on into 2016. And then our current plan is for it to move to Chicago, where we may find its permanent home there at the Field Museum. Not set in concrete yet, but that's looking like that. That's what might happen, and again, that'll occur in 2016. I mentioned just a minute ago the International Year of Soils. This is another really fun activity that ASF is involved with to help raise money for this year of soils celebration that the FAO defined for us a while back. We have a program in place. David Limbaugh has been helping lead from our perspective from soils, where there'll be a video plus other educational materials set up for every month through the year. We saw one of those videos at our board meeting earlier this week, and it was a wonderful video. And so we're really excited about having these tools out there that will help us illustrate the role of soils in agronomy and in almost everyone's lives. There's some role there. And if you want to learn more about the International Year of Soils, there is an exhibit on this, booth 1221 in the exhibit hall. Stop by there. There'll be somebody that will be excited to talk to you about this program. And of course, there's a funding opportunity there because we're trying to raise $150,000 through ASF to support this worthwhile activity. So, and another really exciting program for us, and I'm going to spend some time here introducing you to our scholar recipients in this, is the Golden Opportunity Scholars Institute. Gold Scholars is an ASA, CSSA, SSSA program that matches undergraduates with scientist mentors during this meeting. The program encourages talented students to study agronomy, crops, and soils while cultivating networks to develop the necessary workforce to sustain the profession. So again, a great program that's been around now, I think, since 2005, 2006. We've got around 150 Golden Scholars. So at this point, I would like to announce this year's Gold Scholars. And I would ask the scholars to stand when I read your name, and then we'll hold our applause until all the scholars have been recognized. So our first scholar, Emily K. Baer from Virginia Tech, her mentor, Jennifer Knepp with the U.S. Forest Service. Second, Juliaro Collazo, Texas A&M University. Ray Drippner, University of Nebraska, is the mentor there. Joel Crothier, Brigham Young University in Idaho. Newell Kitchen with USDA ARS. Patrick Curl, Oklahoma State University. Bill Ron from Oklahoma State University is the mentor. Caitlin M. Flick, University of Missouri. Brent Myers, University of Missouri, is the mentor. Armando Guzman, California State University in Fresno. Patrick Dossier, Cola Tech, is the mentor. Rongwei Han, Cornell University. David Meals with Syngenta is the mentor. Mark W. Holmes with the University of Illinois. David Bubeck with DuPont Pioneer is the mentor. Nadia N. Juarez, California State University in Fresno. Andrew Robinson, North Dakota State University, mentor. Samuel E. Noss, Kansas State University. Philip Eppard is the mentor. Sarah C. Mack, University of Maryland. Alan Franz Lubers, USDA ARS, as the mentor. Nicholas Meyer, University of Missouri. Melba Salazar Gutierrez, Washington State University, is the mentor. Bailey Morrell, Iowa State University. Amitava Chatterjee, North Dakota State University, as the mentor. Thomas Privet, North Carolina State University. John Haviland, North Carolina State University, as the mentor. Shelby Redgate, Texas A&M University. Robert Mikic, University of Wisconsin, as the mentor. Fatma Rikic, Cornell University. Nicholas Comerford, University of Florida, as the mentor. Lene Ringler, University of Illinois. Emerson Nopsinger, University of Illinois. Ian Skadden, Brigham Young University. I'm sorry, that's Eden Skadden, Brigham Young University. Kusi Tiwari Monsanto as the mentor. Ian Sprouse, Texas A&M University. Paul Carter, DuPont Pioneer as the mentor. Nicholas Stepig, University of Illinois. Chris Boomsma, Dow AgroSciences as the mentor. Hannah Wall, University of Missouri. Chibwa Chengyu, Dow AgroSciences, as the mentor. That is your group of Golden Scholars for 2014. Let's please welcome them and congratulate them with your applause. I've had the opportunity to meet a number of these Golden Scholars just this week, and it's an amazing group. I mean, we can be very proud, and you come away from a meeting with them and you say, our future is going to be all right. It's going to be good. So it's a great program. Glad to have all the scholars here with us this morning. Some thank yous before I leave the stage. First of all, I would like my fellow Board of Trustees members to stand up, please, that are with us this morning. This is a passionate group. They're just great fun to work with. They love what they're doing, and it's inspiring to be associated with them and to have them working for the foundation. Our chairman, John Haviland, could not be with us this morning. He would normally be giving this report, but does a great job of keeping us sort of all going in the same direction. Also, what makes our job so much easier is the wonderful support that we get from our Madison staff. And I know you hear that from everybody that comes up on this stage, but we really do have a great group there in Madison. And Sarah Utek, Alexander Barton, and of course our Chief Ellen, they just are always there for us, helping us create ideas and then implementing them. And then, of course, our heartfelt appreciation to all the donors, to you folks that support ASF programs. I wouldn't have a report here to give if it wasn't for you. Recognize that your contributions significantly impact the future of our profession, and they do that by impacting people. And as you think about what ASF does, it really is about people that are out there having an impact and an investment in our future. So with that, I thank you on behalf of our board for your contributions, and I'll turn the podium back over to Gene. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Now I would like to call forward Bailey Borrell, the SASIS president from Iowa State University, and she will give the undergraduate student report for 2014.
Good morning. I tell you what, I've got a great group of students. The Students of Agronomy, Soils, and Environmental Sciences organization is at record number of student attendees at this meeting. This year's meeting has drawn over 325 undergraduate students from around the country, Florida to California, and our organization includes over 650 undergraduate SASIS members. In addition to this accomplishment, I would like to share a few other reasons that we should be celebrating. Echoing Dr. Fixon's comments, representing the Soil Science Society of America, the top eight soil judging contestants from last year's competition competed in the first ever international soil judging competition in Korea and won. The top two teams from last November's National Crop Judging Contest, Kansas State and Iowa State, competed in the National Australian Crops Judging Contest, and recently they too brought home a win. Kansas State in first place and Iowa State in second. How incredible is that? The Agronomy Club at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln hosted this year's SASIS regional meeting, held in March. 19 schools were in representation there. Students toured much of the soils and agricultural fields and facilities that Nebraska is known for, as well as some of their state-of-the-art facilities on the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's campus. The Badger Crops Club at the University of Wisconsin-Madison will have the honor of hosting the 2015 regional meetings. The announcement was made at our second SASIS business meeting, and clubs have already begun enthusiastically planning logistics and fundraising. I wish the Badger Crops team the very best in a very successful meeting. At the meeting this weekend, students toured the local area, gaining a better understanding of California's diverse agriculture, competed in speech contests, oral and poster presentations of their research, and earlier this year in a manuscript writing and visual presentations competition. By now, most clubs have made it back to their home state, but I hope you took the opportunity to go view their research and their posters and all of the hard work that they have poured into each and every one of their projects, even if it was only for a moment. They worked incredibly hard, and I'm sure that they appreciated any questions and any feedback that you guys were able to provide, so thank you. This year, we also hosted a consolidated version of the crops judging contest in the exhibit hall. This was an inaugural event at this year's meetings, and it attracted over 85 student registrants. How incredible. As you've heard, we have many reasons to celebrate, but I'd be remiss not to recognize the ongoing support of all three societies and the members who serve us as mentors, judges, coaches, advisors, as well as committee members. What we do is not possible without the support of each and every one of you. So on behalf of the students of agronomy, soils, and environmental sciences, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bailey. That sounds like a great group of student activities, and I look forward to hearing even more in the future. Next, we're going to ask Dave Mingle and Sharon Clay to come forward for the awards and fellows portion of our program.
Good morning. It's been an incredible year, and I'd like to thank everyone that's been supportive. We're going to talk about the Greenfield Scholars. Paul Fixon talked about it a little bit. It was one of my programs that when I went to Madison 2 years ago, I said, this is what I'd like to get done. And Luther Smith, Ellen, the headquarters staff, ASF, Amy Asmus, and many, many other people helped support this program and get it off the ground. So with that, I'd like the Greenfield Scholars to stand when called. So what this program does, it's sponsored by American Society of Agronomy and the International Certified Crop Advisor Program with the specific purpose to support outstanding undergraduates and Bachelor of Science or Associate of Science programs with plans to enter the workforce upon graduation and pursue the Certified Crop Advisor, Certified Professional Agronomist position, and certification. And so this pairs the person with the CCA mentor so that when they get done, they'll know what the CCA is all about, what continuing education credits are, and how to work better in the field. So we have five recipients this year. Melissa Ray Golden, if you would stand, please, Oklahoma State University. Ken Brannick from Pioneer Hybrid International Incorporated is her mentor. Marshall Hay, Iowa State University. John Bergeson, Crop Protection Services, is the mentor. Stephen Charles Parker from Ohio State University. Harold Waters from Ohio State University, the Ohio State University, is the mentor. I'll get it correct. Katrina Sudbeck, Robert Hecht from Soil Solutions Incorporated, and also Fred Vasasek from Servitech Laboratories are the mentors. Hannah M. Wilkerson from South Dakota State University, Amy Asmus from Asmus Farm Supply Incorporated is the mentor. Please give a round of applause to these golden opportunities. And with that, we're going to start the Scholarships and Fellowship Awards. This is basically the Academy Awards of Agronomy. And so will you please help me in celebrating these people's accomplishments. The first award is Cross-Cultural Experience Program Scholarship, James Colton Beal. Colton is a junior at Texas A&M University pursuing two Bachelor of Science degrees, Environmental Sciences and Plant and Environmental Soil Science. Additionally, as a member of the Corps of Cadets, he is pursuing an academic certification in leadership studies from Hollingsworth Program. The next person, and he could not be here today. The next award is the J. Fielding Reed Scholarship. Tyler Sowers. Tyler is an MS student in Soil Science Department at North Carolina State University, researching arsenic sorption to iron oxides. He recently received his BS in Plant and Soil Science from North Carolina State University. Congratulations, Tyler. The Frank D. Kim Graduate Fellowship, Michelle Scarpace. Michelle graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point in May of 2014 with a degree in soil and land management. She will be starting her graduate studies at Kansas State University. Michelle will be working with Dr. Mickey Ransom to further her studies in the podology field. Congratulations, Michelle. The United Soybean Board Fellowship, Anna K. Statsko. Anna is a PhD graduate student in the Department of Plant Pathology at The Ohio State University. She is studying mechanisms of partial resistance in soybean against Phytophthora soljae at the Ohio Agricultural Research and Development Center based in Worcester. Congratulations, Anna. As I understand it, this is the second fellowship. These fellowships are $100,000 and support the student for 4 years, so both of these are very prestigious awards. The second United Soybean Board Fellowship is Clinton J. Statsky. Clinton is a graduate student in the Institute of Plant Breeding, Genetics, and Genomics at the University of Georgia, where he earned his MS in 2014. He received his BS in Crop and Soil Sciences from the Michigan State University in 2012, and he is a former Golden Opportunity Scholar. Congratulations, Clinton. The Congressional Science Fellowship, the recipient is Jennifer Burks. Jen was last year's ACCESS-sponsored AAAS, a Congressional Science Fellow. She was placed in the office of Senator Hirano from Hawaii as a fellow last fall and has recently got hired on full-time member of her staff. Jen currently serves as the Agricultural Legislative Assistant for Senator Hirano. Congratulations, Jennifer. The Mentoring Award recipient received her plaque yesterday, Helga Van Meergroot. She was at the women's lunch ceremony yesterday. Helga is a professor in wildland soils and biogeochemistry at Utah State University in Logan, Utah. Her research focuses on plant-soil interactions and nutrient cycling in wildland ecosystems, including the effects of management, vegetation, and climate on soil carbon storage. Congratulations, Helga. The Mentoring Award is given for showing women how to balance life and careers, and so that's a big honor for women in the sciences. And it's open to men and women, so if you know someone that's a good mentor, please nominate them for that award. The International Certified Crop Advisor of the Year Award, John Hurd. John is a soil fertility extension specialist with Manitoba Agriculture, Food, and Rural Development in Manitoba, Canada. John advises prairie farmers in fertilization practices of oil seeds, cereal, pulse, and forage crops, and technical training for their CCAs. Congratulations, John. ASA Early Career Professional Award, D. Brian Arnell. Brian is a precision nutrient management extension specialist at Oklahoma State University. His program focuses on both traditional agronomic issues and the development techniques implementing existing precision ag technologies in the Southern Great Plains. Congratulations, Brian. The next award is the Environmental Quality Research Award, Douglas L. Carlin. Douglas is a research soil scientist with USDA Agricultural Research Service at the National Laboratory for Agriculture and the Environment. His internationally recognized research program uses soil quality assessment to address environmental impacts of bioenergy feedstock production. Congratulations, Doug. The next award winner is the Carl Sprengel Agronomic Research Award, Raj Khosla. Raj is a professor of precision agriculture at Colorado State University. He shares the administrative responsibility as the Assistant Dean of International Programs at the College of Agricultural Sciences. He earned his MS and PhD degrees from Virginia Tech. Congratulations, Raj. The the Warner L. Nelson Award for Diagnosis of Yield Limiting Factors, Ardell D. Halverson. Ardell is a retired research soil scientist collaborator with USDA ARS in Fort Collins, Colorado. His goal throughout his 42-year career has been to increase the efficiency, productivity, profitability, and sustainability of Great Plains agricultural systems. Congratulations, Ardell. The Agronomic Extension Education Award goes to Sean P. Conley. Sean is a professor of agronomy and the state soybean and small grain specialist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Sean's research and extension goal is to generate science-based solutions to address real-world problems in soybean and small grain production. Cool bean. Congratulations, Sean. Go to the website and look it up. Agronomic Industry Award is Thomas W. Bruelsma. Tom directs research and extension programs in the Northeast region of the North American program of the International Plant Nutrition Institute, a scientific organization dedicated to the responsible management of plant nutrition. Congratulations, Tom. The Agronomic Resident Education Award, Frank M. Hans. Frank is a professor of soil science and agri-life research, faculty fellow in the Department of Soil and Crop Sciences at Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas. He teaches undergraduate and grad courses in soil fertility, chemistry, and studies soil biogeochemistry and carbon sequestration. Congratulations, Frank. The Agronomic Service Award, Jim Dunphy. Jim is a professor of crop science and extension soybean specialist at North Carolina State University. He has responsibility for training NCSU field faculty in soybean production and for otherwise supporting the field faculty's educational programs. Congratulations, Jim. The Congenta Agricultural Science Award, Halen Zhang. Halen is a Regents Professor and Arthur L. Reed Endowed Chair at the Department of Plant and Soil Sciences at Oklahoma State University. He conducts extension and applied research on agricultural testing and nutrient management. Congratulations, Halen. The International Service and Agronomy Award, Craig M. Meisner. Craig is now the country director for World Fish in Bangladesh and South Asia. He has worked with researchers and farmers in Mexico, South and Southeast Asia for over 33 years on wheat, corn, arsenic in the environment, conservation tillage, and is currently working on aquatic agricultural systems. Congratulations, Craig. The ASA Distinguished Service Award goes to Gary Pete A. Peterson. Pete is a professor emeritus and former head of the Soil and Crop Sciences at Colorado State University. He worked with Agronomy Journal and as ASA Editor-in-Chief for 17 years in total. He has degrees from the University of Nebraska and Iowa State University. Congratulations, Pete. And I've served on these award committees, and it is not easy to go through and select all those winners. And so it's a pleasure that all these people have won. If you know some deserving people, make sure that you get them put into the correct slots for these awards. It is now my distinct pleasure. Excuse me. To introduce this year's fellows. Go fellows. Members of the Society nominate worthy colleagues based on their professional achievements and meritorious service. Up to 0.3% of the Society's active and emeritus members may be elected as fellow. This year's fellows include Arthur L. Allen, Arthur is a professor, associate research director, and director of the university-wide Spatial Technology Center at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. His research on nutrient management is recognized internationally and has had major impact on the Mid-Atlantic coastal plain. Congratulations, Arthur. The next fellow who is not attending this year is Herman Bolero. Herman is a professor and head of the Department of Crop Sciences, University of Illinois. Dr. Bolero studies the quantitative assessment of the environmental services and productivity attributes of cropping systems. He teaches courses in experimental design and multivariate analysis. The next fellow is Dennis L. Corwin. Dennis is a research soil scientist at the University ARS U.S. Salinity Lab in Riverside, California. His research focuses on the use of geophysical techniques to map and monitor non-point source pollutants, particularly salinity and trace elements, and to characterize soil spatial variability. Congratulations, Dennis. The next fellow is Gregory K. Ivanilo. Greg is a professor and extension specialist in the Department of Crop and Soil Environmental Sciences at Virginia Tech. He studies and provides extension programming on byproduct composting and beneficial use of land-applied agricultural, municipal, and industrial waste. Congratulations, Greg. Fernando O. Garcia. Fernando is a regional director of the Latin American Southern Cone Program of the International Plant Nutrition Institute. He develops research and educational programs on soil fertility and management and crop production at Argentina, Bolivia, Chile, Paraguay, and Uruguay. Congratulations, Fernando. Robert J. Goose. Jay is a professor of soil science at the Department of Soil Science at North Dakota State University in Fargo, where he has served for 34 years. 34 years in Fargo, that's, you know, that's enough to get anybody. He currently teaches Introduction to Soil Science and conducts research in the area of plant nutrition and fertilizer management. Congratulations, Robert. E. Raymond Hunt, Jr. Ray is a research physical scientist at the USDA Agricultural Research Services Beltsville Agricultural Research Center in Beltsville, Maryland. He conducts research in remote sensing to develop applications for agricultural and natural resource management. Congratulations, Ray. James A. Ippolito. Jim is a research soil scientist at the USDA ARS Northwestern Irrigation and Soil Research Laboratory in Kimberly, Idaho. He studies the linkages between soil and irrigation water quality as they affect inorganic biogeochemical transformations and crop productivity, and he served as a board rep for several years. Corinne M. Kitterings. Dr. Kitterings is a professor of nutrient management and agricultural systems at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. She conducts applied on-farm research, teaches a capstone course, and leads the college's statewide extension program in field crops, nutrient fertilizer, and manure management. Congratulations, Corinne. Harry B. Kirshnan. Harry is a research molecular biologist with USDA ARS and adjunct professor in the Division of Plant Sciences at the University of Missouri. He earned his MS and BS degrees from India and his PhD from the Washington State University. Congratulations, Harry. Robert Bob M. Lacey. Bob is a research manager in environmental programs at military ranges and lands for the Army's Engineer Research and Development Center in Champaign, Illinois. As an ASA board member and program planning officer, he played major roles in the success of the ASA organization restructuring from sections to communities. Congratulations, Bob. Bao Gao Lee. Dr. Lee is a distinguished professor at Soil and Water Sciences Department, College of Natural Resource and Environmental Sciences, China Agricultural University. He received his BS and PhD from Beijing Agricultural University. Congratulations, Dr. Lee. Hengsheng Henry Lin. Henry is a professor of hydropedology, soil hydrology in the Department of Ecosystem Science and Management at the Pennsylvania State University. He is internationally recognized as an authority on hydropedology and critical zone science. Congratulations, Henry. Perry Ray Miller. Perry is a professor of sustainable cropping systems at Montana State University in Bozeman, Montana. He studies crop diversity effects on crop productivity, soil properties, and economic optimization in both conventional no-till and organic systems under dry land management. Congratulations, Perry. P.V. Vera Prasad. Vera is a professor of crop ecophysiology and director of the Center for Sorghum Improvement in the Department of Agronomy at Kansas State University. His research focuses on understanding responses of crops to changing environments and developing management strategies to improve crop yields. Congratulations, Vera. Arel Soji. Arel is a research soil scientist at the USDA ARS Services Coastal Plain Soil, Water, and Plant Research Center in Florence, South Carolina. He studies use of agricultural waste and nutrient recovery technologies for sustainable agricultural production and environmental protection. Excuse me. Congratulations, Arel. Curtis R. Thompson. Curtis is a professor and extension state leader in the Department of Agronomy at Kansas State University. His research and extension programs focus on weed management and field crops, including strategies to manage herbicide-resistant weeds. Congratulations, Curtis. One of the things that we have to do is make those sentences shorter. Put in some commas now and then. I would now like to invite Dave Mengel to the lectern to present the presidential award and give his presidential report. Congratulations.
Well, good morning. Thank you all for coming. It's a great pleasure to present our first presidential award. We started this just a year ago. And one of my responsibilities as president was to find that perfect candidate for our first presidential award. And so I surveyed all of our former presidents to get good ideas from them. I got a lot of good suggestions. But it really gives me great pleasure to present this first one. And the first winner, this thing's sensitive. Is Dr. John Pesek. John's a pioneer in our organization. He's the Curtis Distinguished Professor Emeritus in Agriculture and Life Sciences and honorary alum of Iowa State. He was head of the Agronomy Department from 1964 to 1990. How he survived that long, I do not know. They were ready to run me out on a rail at 8 years. So he was president of the ASA in 1979. President of SSSA in 1986. In addition to all that, he mentored 38 graduate students in sustainable agriculture. Unfortunately, John was not able to be with us today, but he sends his gratitude for this honor. Former President Ken Moore, actually presented the plaque to John about 2 weeks ago in the department there at Iowa State. So please join me in congratulating Dr. Pesek. Now I have the opportunity to bore you for a few minutes. And I have to be careful not to steal all of Ellen's thunder, as the previous presidents have. But I do have a few things I want to talk about looking forward in our society. We're kind of at a crossroads to a certain extent. We've survived the big transition to being independent societies over the past 5 years. And I'd just like to take a second, look forward to and talk about some of the strengths that we have to build on as we continue this transformation. A few of the challenges, the little things we have to address as we go along, but also some of the tremendous opportunities we have, because there's no question we have some. If we think about building on our strengths, we have a great tradition, and we have a relatively unique tradition among the three tri-societies. I don't know how many of you can remember back to the old agronomy society with our previous divisions and our humongous board that was composed of all three societies. But we now are a new society. We're lean and mean, but we've got to remember our tradition and build on it. The other two societies can very proudly proclaim that they are scientific societies. Their primary function in both of those societies has been and continues to be the generation of new knowledge. Our society has always had a slightly different bent. I was a member of agronomy many years ago. In fact, I was division chair of A4, Extension Agronomy. I also was very active in A1 at one point, education. Bob Lacey was just up here. He was involved in military land management. We've had the research land manager division for many years. My point is simply that we have a tradition that's much broader than just the generation of science. We have a very, very strong tradition for the application of science. And I think we have a unique opportunity coming to us to build on that tradition and expand our breadth of opportunities, our breadth of service to society, and our breadth of service to agronomists. So it's something that we really need to think about. Fran Pierce, when he was president, and Newell Kitchen, some of the others, brought us to the community structure. Did away with divisions, and now we look at communities. A tremendous opportunity to encourage interdisciplinary activities, and to also maintain that link between the three tri-societies. Wonderful strength that they don't have, though they're beginning to talk about copying it, so it must be pretty good. But we still have two great partners, formally through the Access program, if you will, that manages our affairs, but CSSA and SSSA are all still important parts, and many of you are members of at least one of those societies. I am, and I know most of you are. In fact, we really don't have any just agronomy members. There's something else, too, and that's an important strength that we build on. We have great people. Currently, we have 7,907 members as of September 30th, and that's a slight tick up. These are very active people. Many of you folks are very active in our society, serve on committees, serve on boards, serve on task forces. Greatly appreciate that. One of the aspects of the community structure is it not only requires a lot more volunteer leaders, because each community, and there's 47, I believe, the last count, each one requires a chair and a vice chair. But that's a great way also to introduce people into the leadership of our society, and we can build on those leaders. And so that's a really important strength that we have. We have a steady influx of student members. One of the reasons we continue to grow is because SASIS continues to grow. But one of the downsides is they don't stay. And that's something that we really need to address as we go forward. Our active member participation is actually on a decline. And if you think of our traditional membership base for our active members, it's old white men like me who work at land-grant universities and ARS. We have to expand that. We have to think broader, because that base is shrinking also. I don't know how many of you look at your own home departments, but when I became department head at K-State 17 years ago, there were more people in it than there are now. And I think that's the case in most departments around the country. There's actually a few less departments than there were 17 years ago. So it's important that we think about how are we going to maintain and how are we going to serve. We've got a great headquarters staff. People have talked about Ellen, they've talked about Sarah, and talked about others, but it's much more than that. It's people like Keith. It's people like Marta. It's people like Madeline. I mean, just you go down the list. It's Nate when he meets you at the door, or Rebecca when they meet you at the door. They're wonderful people. They're very loyal. They stay with us forever. Nobody leaves. They retire, maybe. But they don't leave. And so that's really, really important. It really provides us with a lot of continuity in our programming. It allows us to do a lot of things that we probably couldn't do without their very, very strong support. So we're very fortunate there. We also have a very good certification program. 13,000 roughly certified crop advisors. About 700 or 800, somewhere in that range, certified professional agronomists. But unfortunately, only about 20% of that certification base is actually a member of our society. They look to us for the certification, they look to us for continuing education, they look to us for direction, but they aren't members. We need to turn that around. We need to look more to them to be part of our overall program to help us in the extension and the application of this great science that our three societies generate. We're also in pretty decent shape financially, which is very fortunate because everybody isn't today. Our access structure allows us to share our costs for operating our societies among our three partners, the three partners. We have a substantial, relatively, I'm going to use the term balanced budget. It is, in a special way. It's balanced because we have significant investments that provide substantial investment income, which allows us to create new programs and allows us to do probably more than we could with our straight operating budget. So that's a blessing that we have to deal with. But we have to be careful in the process of doing that, that we don't kill the goose that lays the golden eggs. As I look forward to the things that I've learned in the last 2.5 years being involved in the executive group, I see some challenges. One is we can't be too tightly bound by tradition. Because there are some things that we need to do differently. We need to be open and be open to expansion, open to change, because there's a lot of great ideas out there that people come to us each year with. We really need to find a significant place in our society for our non-academic professional members. I've trained about 43 or 44 graduate students. There's only one of those that currently is a tenure-track faculty member at a land-grant university. Most of them were MS people. Several started in the university system but found that it was too constricting to them, and they went off into business. Some of them are no longer members. And that's unfortunate. We have to find a way to keep that talent present in our society. They can contribute so much. Many of them, the majority of them, were MS students. I still keep in touch with them, but none of them are members. Many of them are certified, either as agronomists or soil scientists or crop advisors, but they aren't members. We're losing a lot of talent, a lot of quality. And if you talk to our editors, a lot of potential reviewers, which is very important because that's a significant issue for us today. We also need to think a little bit about expanding our role internationally. CCA program is looking at expanding to Mexico right now. One of the discussions that came up is they don't really have a Mexican agronomy society. Is this something we should help them? Should we facilitate? Not go in and take charge by any means, but help them facilitate that process. I think this is, there's some opportunities for us there to provide some real service in many parts of the world. We also need to be inclusive, very inclusive. We have the traditional thought processes of gender and race and ethnicity, but it's more than that. We need to think about other disciplines and how we can bring them into our society to interact with us, because agriculture today is not just an issue of main effects. It's interactions. It requires interdisciplinary activities. Places that we haven't even, that I never thought about before, I'm now interacting with people on a regular basis. People in nutrition, in food science, in statistics. It's extremely important that we do that. So we really have to think about how can we get these people involved, whether it's formally, bring their societies in formally through access, help provide them services. Is it through our community structure? Is it through a new membership program that allows someone in another society to also participate easily within our society? Great opportunity for us that we need to think about. We also can have to continue to work diligently on selling our science to policymakers. I've had the pleasure of working with the Science Policy Group now for about a year and a half, 2 years, and it's really eye-opening. The things that we deal with, the letters that we sign on to, the letters that we write, the other groups that we interact with. I participated in congressional visit days last year. And having that team of students and CCAs, the CCAs are a lot of them small businessmen, having them come into their congressman's office, they get a hell of a lot more attention than I do. And that's really important, and it can really help us in the long run to have a much greater impact. The other thing we have to do is we have to make sure that we use our resources wisely. There's lots of ideas and lots of places we can do things, but we have to make sure those resources are channeled in to take advantage, to get the most bang for our buck. And so that's going to be a challenge over the next few years as we address some of our issues and look at all of these new possibilities that come to us every day. With that, I'm going to quit. I wanted to keep it as short as I could, and I really want to say thank you. I want to say thank you for the opportunity to be up here today. This has been a tremendous opportunity for me, one that I greatly, greatly appreciate. And I also would encourage all of you to think seriously about how you can take advantage of some of these opportunities within our society for leadership. We have elections coming up. We have elections for section leaders and community leaders and board reps and presidents. And you all should consider it because you all have skills that we can utilize within our science and our society. So think about that seriously. Thank you very much. And at this point, I'll turn the podium over to Ellen, and we'll let her give us a few remarks.
Good morning.
I just love to get around all of you guys every year. It's just invigorating. I have to just say thank you for all of you being here, for being great members. It's fantastic to just go through the tables on my way to the bathroom and talk with so many people. Hey, you guys know me. I'm a down-to-earth kind of person, so I'm telling it like it is. You know, I'm just trying to make my way out the door, and I stop at five tables just saying hello, and again, just being reminded how wonderful our membership is. And as Dave was saying, the diversity and the strength of the membership of agronomy is unique because of that breadth of the lab to field, bench science to application is fantastic. And the more we can look at taking advantage of that, utilizing that as we educate the general public, our policymakers, et cetera. That's incredibly important. I also, just one of the items, the lean and mean. I'll take issue with the mean just because I was reminded by a couple of our members talking to staff saying they go to a number of different meetings and ours are the most friendly meetings. We try to be inclusive. We try to say hello to each other. We get our students involved. We connect people. And I think that's incredibly important, you know, just in terms of helping people make those connections and facilitate that. And the person that I know who does that really the best for me and that helps across the society is Sarah Utek. And we talk about that, about your web of people. I call her Spider Woman. So just to talk a little bit about, well, I haven't reported out on any numbers here at the meeting. We're having a great meeting. We're hitting close to record attendance. We're over 4,200, and that was as of this time yesterday morning. I haven't checked as, you know, later in the day. We also, with our food bank activity on the opening evening, we raised almost $1,700 for the local food bank. So I think that that's really something that is a nice gesture to the community, and to let them know that we exist. It's another way that we can extend that influence. There are a number of different projects, thinking about where we are from a financial standpoint. The benefit of having a nice investment balance is that we also, through the leadership of prior presidents, established a reinvest ASA fund that a number of you have submitted projects to, and those projects are kicking off and really focusing on student activities, on communicating our science outwardly, and trying to do more there. Another activity here at the meeting for the first time, we had a graduate student leadership conference that happened over the weekend, and we anticipate expanding that and continuing those types of activities to a greater degree. I would be remiss if I didn't mention all that we're doing in publications. We've had a huge emphasis on our publications activities. And as many of you know, unfortunately, we lost one of our great staff leaders in that area, Mark Mandelbaum, earlier this year to illness. But he really helped us in creating our digital library and establishing the fact that all three of our societies, because we work together, again, that strength and that of working together and partnering, all of our journals being in one spot, we've attracted other journals. We're continuing to attract other journals in the agricultural and natural resources disciplines. And because of that, we're going to have a greater opportunity to sell our information, to expand the dissemination of our sciences internationally because of the, again, the attractiveness of the amount of information that we're able to really collect through our digital library. We might not be able to really compete toe-to-toe with Elsevier, but we've got our niche, and we're going to continue to expand that. I think at that point, I'm just going to cut it off because I don't like to talk for a long period of time, but I really want to thank all of you as members, as volunteers. I want to thank the boards of directors, all of our committees and so forth that we get to work with on a day-to-day basis as staff, and just thank our staff as well because we've got a fantastic staff, as has been mentioned. They really do a tremendous amount of work and are very loyal to each and every one of you in terms of advancing the profession and our sciences. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Ellen. Jean, would you please come join me on the stage? This is a time in the program that I can tell you my wife has been looking forward to, where we symbolically pass the gavel. And so, Jean, it's all yours. Good luck.
Thank you, Dave. It's really an honor to step into the position of president of this wonderful society. And as one of my first actions, I would like to offer my thanks to Dave. He has provided wonderful leadership, and we count on his continuing leadership as our past president. but I want to present him this trophy or a plaque on behalf of the Society. The American Society of Agronomy gratefully acknowledges the services of David B. Mingle as 2014 president. So we're going to close this morning's program with a very special event, the E.T. and Van York Distinguished ASA Lectureship. It was established in 2001 by Dr. and Mrs. E.T. York, Jr. in recognition of the importance of agronomic science and Dr. York's impact on the profession, as evidenced by his contributions to research, education, and administration. Dr. York was a former University of Florida Vice President for Agriculture and Natural Resources, in addition to serving as Executive Vice President and Interim President and Chancellor Emeritus of the State University System. He retired from academia in 1980 to devote his time to fighting global hunger, primarily by improving agriculture infrastructure in developing countries, and he continued those activities until his death in 2011. So it's my pleasure to introduce the 2014 E.T. and Van York Lectureship, Dr. Barbara Burlingame. I had the privilege of serving presenting at a conference with her last winter, and as soon as I heard her presentation there, I knew that that was the person I had been looking for that would present this lecture this morning. Barbara obtained her PhD in nutrition science from Massey University in New Zealand and undergraduate degrees in University of California, Davis. She recently retired as the Deputy Director of Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations, which she joined in 1998. Before joining FAO, Dr. Burlingame spent 12 years as the nutrition program leader at New Zealand's Institute for Crop and Food Research, and she currently is a senior advisor to the Millennium Institute in Washington, D.C., an honorary professor at Deakin University in Melbourne, Australia, a faculty member of the American University of Rome, and the specialty chief editor of Frontiers in Nutrition and Environmental Sustainability. Her expertise includes food composition, nutrient requirements, biodiversity for food and nutrition, sustainable diets, and food systems. So please join me in giving a warm welcome to Barbara Burlingame.
Thank you, Jean, and thank you to ASA for the invitation to speak at this meeting. I'm a human nutritionist, a nutrition scientist, but my background is nutrition through the agriculture sector rather than the public health sector. And one of the things I like to try to convince the agriculture sector to do is to reclaim nutrition as their domain. Reclaim it from the medical, clinical, health side. Not completely, but at least a little bit more than it is right now. So my talk is Sustainable Diets, Linking Nutrition, Agriculture, and the Environment. We have so many issues, so much that is not sustainable. Diets are not sustainable. FAO every year calculates the number of hungry people in the world. This year, on World Food Day, the number was released. It's come down a bit, but it has been fluctuating not very much in the 800 million range. Currently, it is estimated that 805 million people in the world are chronically hungry. In addition to that, 2 billion people around the world suffer from micronutrient malnutrition, and another couple of billion people are overweight or obese. That includes more than 42 million children under the age of 5. These are health issues, but they're agriculture sector issues too. Environments are not sustainable. Ecosystems have been degraded. Biodiversity loss continues, and some of that biodiversity loss will never be recovered. And agriculture in many parts of the world is not sustainable the way it's currently practiced. Monoculture agriculture, intensive livestock industries, the use and overuse of agricultural chemicals, food losses and waste along the food chains and within food systems, and inefficiencies everywhere. Sorry, this slide isn't very clear, but what I wanted to illustrate with this slide is the number of hungry people, which was typically FAO's mandate, deal with providing food to feed the world. And there have been many successes in that, but the consequence is that in many developed, in all developed, and in most developing countries, obesity rates exceed the prevalence of undernourishment. Dietary energy supply is our metric here, also body mass index. And throughout the world, including sub-Saharan Africa, obesity rates exceed underweight and the other anthropometric measures of malnutrition. Oops, wrong way. Stunting prevalence has decreased around the world. Stunting is height for age in children under the age of 5. It's come down a lot in Asia. It's come down a lot in Latin America, and it has been stagnant at a very high rate in Africa. Overweight prevalence in developing countries is going up hugely. It's a huge problem in Asia. It's been a huge problem for a long time, and it continues to increase in Latin America. And in Africa, the problem is increasing every year. And micronutrient malnutrition is a problem everywhere. We map micronutrient malnutrition. This happens to be a map of iron deficiency, vitamin A deficiency, and iodine. And throughout the world, regardless of where on the dietary energy spectrum a person or a nation sits, micronutrient malnutrition is a huge problem. For this reason, including all the sustainability issues, at Rio Plus 20 a couple of years ago, the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon issued something called the Zero Hunger Challenge. It is aspirational. It's not really, these are not really targets. But 100% access to adequate food all year round for everyone, zero stunted children, all food systems are sustainable, 100% growth in smallholder productivity and income, and zero losses in weight. But it is not, it's not at all surprising that in the center of the Zero Hunger Challenge is all food systems are sustainable. And among the sustainability issues that FAO has been dealing with, together with partners in the CG system, Biodiversity International and some of the other research institutes, and other UN agencies, and civil society, has been sustainable diets. Because we look at the problems. The health sector has a unit of nutrition that is the individual nutrients. And their solutions involve fortificants, injections, ready-to-use therapeutic foods, and the medicalized pharmaceutical approach. FAO and the agriculture sector has had food as the metric or the basic unit of nutrition. And we have achieved some successes, and there certainly is enough food in the world. We have other distribution kind of problems. But we still haven't solved the problems of malnutrition. We need diet as the basic unit of nutrition. So through a number of activities, a definition which eluded us for a long time was finally agreed on sustainable diets. Sustainable diets are those diets with low environmental impacts, which contribute to food and nutrition security and to healthy life for present and future generations. They are protective and respectful of biodiversity and ecosystems. They are culturally acceptable, accessible, economically fair and affordable. They are nutritionally adequate, safe, and healthy while optimizing both natural and human resources. And this definition came at the end of the first International Scientific Symposium on Sustainable Diets and Biodiversity. And the subtitle to the publication out of that is Directions and Solutions for Policy, Research, and Action. And there is a huge research agenda encompassed by this. At that same conference, which actually activities had begun prior to that, a discussion took place on, do we need a code of conduct for sustainable diets? And it was discussed in the context of one of the most powerful codes of conduct ever in existence, at least in our nutrition world, and that is the code of conduct for the marketing of breast milk substitutes. And I think most people know that there have been very successful boycotts of infant formula companies around the world that were promoting infant formulas for women who really didn't have the capacity to use them and as a substitute for breastfeeding, which is the ideal way to nourish a baby. So using that as a model and thinking of fortificants and individual nutrients provided in ready-to-use therapeutic formulations as the equivalent for adults and children who are not infants, equivalent to infant formulas, a preamble for the Code of Conduct on Sustainable Diets was developed, recognizing that the health of humans cannot be isolated from the health of ecosystems, conscious that food is an unequaled way of providing ideal nutrition for all ages and life stages, and recognizing that when ecosystems are able to support sustainable diets, that nutrition programs, policies, and interventions supporting the use of supplements, ready-to-use therapeutic foods, fortificants, individual added nutrients to staple foods, and infant formulas are inappropriate, and the marketing of these food substitutes and related products can contribute to major public health problems. And I found this cartoon on the blog of a little boy who was in the U.S., and he was solving the problems for us. And it's Albert Einstein saying, solution to world hunger, it's food. It is food. It's not medicine, but it's food in the package of a diet. So why is biodiversity so fundamental to this? We have a huge loss of biodiversity in the world as we strive for uniformity in our agricultural production, as we strive for greater yield and better disease resistance, and we lose a lot of biodiversity. We've lost a lot of rice biodiversity, for example. Thousands of varieties existed in the past. We cannot find these varieties in cultivation anymore, and huge areas of land are cultivated under one, two, maybe three different varieties of rice, and that's it. Nutritionally, this is important because among the genetic characteristics of these different varieties are nutrient fingerprints. There are biosynthetic pathways. There are nutrient compositional differences that are specific to the variety. I have a 30-year career in food composition. There are many, many reasons why nutrient composition will be different, but that genetic resource, at the taxonomic level below species, we have varietal differences that are related to that genetic characteristic. In the USDA food composition tables, we have very little data on biodiversity, unfortunately. But in other databases around the world, we have a lot of information at the level of variety or cultivar or breed of animal. Protein is one example. We tend to have year-round nationwide mixed varietal value, an average for the protein content of rice. It's around 8.5. But that masks the low end, the cultivars with low protein content, and it can be as low as 5%, 5 grams per 100 grams, or as high as nearly 15. And we don't recognize this when we do our nutritional studies, when we do our national surveys like your NHANES that is run yearly in the U.S. by USDA. So we need to look at varietal differences that are nutritionally significant. So it's protein, it's iron, it's zinc, it's calcium, it's B vitamins, thiamine, riboflavin, niacin, it's carbohydrate fractions, amylose, it is many things that we don't even classify as nutrients, all that huge realm of bioactive non-nutrients. Now, recognizing that there is a huge genetic and nutritional diversity in rice, the International Rice Commission made some recommendations. They recommended that the existing biodiversity of rice varieties and their nutritional composition be explored before engaging in transgenic modification of rice. That makes a lot of sense. This didn't happen before golden rice and the first generation of golden rice with the daffodil gene providing that biosynthetic pathway for beta carotene. But subsequently, they made this recommendation. Nutrient content needs to be among the criteria in cultivar promotion, not just yield, and that cultivar-specific nutrient analysis and data dissemination should be systematically undertaken. They also made some recommendations to their members, member countries. They should promote the sustainable development of aquatic biodiversity in rice-based ecosystems, and policy decisions and management measures should enhance the living aquatic resource base. And that areas where wild fish are depleted, rice fish farming should be considered as a means of enhancing food security and ensuring the sustainable rural development. And that attention should be given to the nutritional contribution of aquatic organisms in the diet of rural people who produce and depend on rice. And we did some studies looking at a rice-based aquatic ecosystem, not intensive agriculture, quite the opposite. And what are the sources of nutrients, high-quality protein, the important individual fatty acids, and vitamins and minerals. And it wasn't the rice, it was the other aquatic organisms in that ecosystem. And we could look at Cambodia, China, and Laos in this and see that the quality of the diet in these communities came from not intensive agriculture. It came from agriculture that allowed the ecosystem to operate the way it's always operated, and their micronutrient requirements and their high-quality protein requirement was met through these other, let's call them, ecosystem services. I was for a long time the editor of the Journal of Food Composition and Analysis, and we started to get a lot of papers on varietal differences in nutrient content. This one was my favorite for a couple of reasons. It shows huge differences in beta carotene. Beta carotene is your pro vitamin A carotenoid, your most potent. So we see some varieties. This is calculated in milligrams per 100 gram fresh weight. So some varieties, 12, 13 milligrams per 100 gram fresh weight. That's way above a nutrient requirement for a child. And we see other varieties, one, two orders of magnitude lower in beta carotene content. The interesting thing about this study, which was conducted in Pacific Island countries where vitamin A deficiency was rampant and children were going blind, the agriculture extension workers were promoting the low beta carotene varieties of sweet potato because they had higher yield, they had better disease resistance, and the result was the local varieties were not used, and the population, if they were lucky enough, got some supplements so the children didn't go blind, but the population was chronically malnourished for micronutrients, vitamin A in particular. And this is one of my favorite stories. If any of you went to the movie last night, Sizzle, which was a very good movie, he talked about something called the art plot, the filmmaker. And if there's an art plot in the story on biodiversity for food and nutrition, I think it's this banana. We have the Cavendish banana here that everybody knows, right? It's kind of a monumental success and a monumental failure in agriculture for what it has achieved. But in many countries, we have this huge biodiversity of bananas. Up here, we have some pictures of the bananas of Micronesia. And we have banana varieties. Okay, so the Cavendish banana has basically no provitamin A carotenoid. It might be reported as 5, but that's the noise of the analytical instrument. We have the carrot banana. It's called carrot, that's the local name, with more than 8,500 micrograms per 100 grams of beta-carotene. And this banana was growing wild forever in Micronesia, but in the jungles, falling to the ground, rotting, and they were importing this Cavendish banana from Honduras and Costa Rica into Micronesia, and there was a high prevalence of vitamin A deficiency and one of the highest prevalences in the world of xerophthalmia, which is the eye disorder that comes from vitamin A deficiency, and children were blind. A researcher in the 80s decided that we needed to know what the beta-carotene or the pro-vitamin A carotenoid content was of these wild bananas, and she did those analyses, and the public health community was thrilled with this, and the government was thrilled with this, so much so that you can see in the lower corner the postage stamps of the Federated States of Micronesia promotes the biodiversity of the local varieties of bananas by putting their picture on the stamps. So that was kind of great. And she, the woman who was a pioneer in this research, she died a few years ago, but she is really quite a hero in some of these countries for the work that she did on promoting the local biodiversity for improving nutrition. But we need to look at the ecosystem as a whole. I'm a reductionist nutrition scientist, and I'm not ashamed to say that, but at the same time, I think the work that we do to pull out little pieces, which is the best way to analyze something, we need to put it back in to see how it works. So this is one of my favorite stories about looking at the big picture, looking at the holistic situation. I was always curious about Mongolia. Mongolia is, I'm not using this little arrow pointer very well. Here's Mongolia, if you can see my pointer. It is that color in this map because it is has a high level of what FAO calls food insecurity, and it's always had that as long as FAO has been reporting on food insecurity in the world. So Mongolia is a landlocked country, chronically food insecure, and a nutritionist goes to Mongolia and thinks, where do they get their omega-3 fatty acids? They don't have any seafood, and they don't have lakes, they don't eat fish, and of course we know that most of what most of us use to get our N-3 or omega-3 fatty acid requirements met is fish. They get it from the milk of the local horse breed. They have a local horse breed forever, unique, and the genetic trait of that horse combined with the scruffy little pasture plants in the steppes of Mongolia, which contain high levels of omega-3 fatty acids, together give the population of Mongolia the ability to meet their N1 or their omega-3 fatty acid requirements. The biodiversity of the grasslands is unique. The genetic trait of this horse is unique. You change one thing in that picture, and well-meaning interventions are doing that, bringing in a higher yielding breed of dairy animal or different different feed regime for the horses. The net result is that the population will need to have supplements. They'll need that medicalized approach to meeting their nutrient requirements, particularly for the omega-3 fatty acids. So this is why, even beyond diet, the ecosystem and the code of conduct for sustainable diets, when an ecosystem is able to provide those nutrients required by a population, use those nutrients, and characterize that ecosystem for nutrition before engaging in interventions that may cause a lot of collateral damage. And livestock has a bad reputation in the world of sustainability, climate change, and even human nutrition. And for that reason, we wanted to study the situation in the context of sustainable diets. So the second international scientific symposium on sustainable diets was on livestock and human nutrition. There are many trade-offs and many dilemmas. We know that livestock, meat, provide rich sources of micronutrients, very concentrated and very bioavailable. But we also know that high intake of meat increases the risk for non-communicable diseases. We know that intensive livestock industries lead to deforestation. But we also know that the natural repositories of plant biodiversity with livestock as a synergistic part of that are huge. They're very important for biodiversity conservation. We have the global carbon balances that are affected by livestock industries, both the intensive and extensive. But we also have these fibrous pasture plants. We can't eat them, and we don't want to mow them down and plant soybeans. The best way to maintain those fibrous pasture plants is to let the cattle eat them, let the livestock. So thus, it was concluded at this conference, we need to look at the context, that is, the food system or the ecosystem, for guidance on what our interventions should be, and guide also the research questions. And the essence of sustainable diets is an ecosystem approach. And again, a very big research potential to be mined in that concept. I see I'm running out of time, so I'll skip some of the protein things. Oh, except that year after next is the International Year of Pulses, and that will be an interesting international year, and I think everybody here could play a big role. I just wanted to point out that pulse production is going up all the time if we measure it in tons. But if we look at it as human food, the pulse is in grams per person per day for availability for consumption has gone way down. And that is something that that could and should be reversed. I'll skip. The banana story and some of the other stories, case studies with data, compositional data, dietary intake data, data on not so much soil, but traditional food systems, can be found in some of the books that FAO has published together with CINE, the Center for Indigenous Nutrition and the Environment. And these two books, full text on the FAO website, provide the banana story in Pohnpei and some other stories where we look at the biodiversity, the ecosystem, the traditions, and how far the indigenous peoples have departed from those and what the consequences are. So the biodiversity loss in nutrition is high prevalence of non-communicable diseases, overweight and obesity, and also sometimes stunting, wasting, and underweight in children. I think maybe I should skip the food losses and waste too, because I'm running out of time. Yes, okay. But I would love to spend a few minutes on this. I won't, but I'll give you the punchline. Obesity is an agriculture sector issue, not just a health sector issue. And this might be interesting to USDA people. Food waste is a huge problem in the world, and FAO estimates that at least a third, if not more, of food produced is wasted. In developing countries, it's at the farm, it's post-harvest. In developed countries, it's the food available for consumption. So the U.S. published this poster: buy it with thought, cook it with care, use less wheat and meat, buy local foods, serve just enough, use what's left and don't waste it. This poster was issued in 1918 in the U.S. by what was called the U.S. Food Administration. I really like that poster. And the environmental footprint, if you look at the Mediterranean diet pyramid, the foods at the top are the foods you should eat the least. And we placed an environmental footprint pyramid, an upside-down pyramid. It really illustrates well that the foods we should eat the least of have the highest environmental footprint. And in the U.S., I saw this cartoon. I remember when Hostess was going out of business, and the emotion that Americans had to save the Twinkie. So I love this cartoon, because you've got thousands of people trying to save the Twinkie, and two little people off to the side saying, save the Earth. And they say, we're doomed. But I don't think we're doomed, because I think we have enough people, enough scientists to deal with some of the problems that we have. This one I'll just quickly mention. The Commission on Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture, at its recent meeting, had a review of key issues on biodiversity and nutrition. And among other things, they declared that the concept of nutrients in food and whole diets, as well as food, should be explicitly regarded as ecosystem services. I think this is great, and this also provides a nice research agenda for people like you. And this is my last slide, my last content slide. The Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, Olivier de Schutter, finished his role. He reported directly to the Secretary General of the UN. In his final report, this is the Right to Food, he said, we need to reshape food systems for the promotion of sustainable diets and effectively combat the different phases of malnutrition. Where local ecosystems and resources are able to support sustainable diets, we need to systematically ensure that such interventions prioritize local solutions. Any prescription to increase yields that ignore the need to transition to sustainable production and consumption and to reduce rural poverty will not only be incomplete, may also have damaging impacts, worsening the ecological crisis and widening the gap between different categories of food producers, and that moving toward sustainable modes of agricultural production is vital for future food security and an essential component of the right to food. Agroecology has an enormous potential in that regard. And these are the challenges. A single sector by itself will initiate policies and actions that damage other sectors. We see this often. It is the coming together of sectors that can provide the sustainable solutions, and a big research agenda here. Mistakes of the past need to be corrected. Present-day problems need solutions, and the future urgently needs protection. Thank you.
Barbara, thank you very much for that presentation. Barbara will be with us for the rest of the conference, so I hope some of you will have an opportunity to visit with her. And at this time, Barbara, on behalf of the members of the American Society of Agronomy, I have a plaque of expressing our gratitude. The American Society of Agronomy recognizes Barbara Burlingame as a distinguished scholar presenting the 2014 E.T. and Van Dort Distinguished ASA Lectureship funded through the American or the Agronomic Science Foundation. So, Barbara, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with that, we're going to close this morning's reception. I appreciate your presence. I urge you to go out and enjoy all of the other wonderful activities of the day, and to join us at 4:30 for the closing reception and Randy Olson's keynote closing lecture.